so this is a bit of a ride. And we've got no individual day is really hard. It's meant to be around when they're ready for the door conversation.
She's going away from
we have children quite young, and one of the things we say is that that means, you know, once they're grown up, once they're in their 40s, they get to talk to them in terms of change, and partly you're like, yeah, that's true, partly that, well, you can't just, yeah, you are. You still are parenting them after the life.
What we found is that when they're little, it's, have they read their reading book? When they're 14, 15, it's much more fun. Which university they get to,
it's less easy when they have a problem. It's not simple to solve it. When they're five, you can solve it. When they're 15, they're deeper.
Good evening, everyone. I don't know where to stand without being in the spotlight. Here we are, so we're here. Hello. Welcome. It's lovely to see you. My name's Dan. I'm the pastor of Christchurch Tilehurst. And we had Pete Killiney from Care with us this morning, and he was going to put on a seminar for us on assisted dying. And we thought, let's invite some other friends to come along as well. So I'm really grateful to Jamie and Argyle for allowing us to kind of host the meeting, because we don't have a building. We meet in the school hall, so that's been really kind for Argyle to join us. So we've got Christchurch here. We've got any from Argyle? We've got Argyle folk, yes. Anywhere else? You don't have to tell us. All right. From different places. Okay, well, it's nice to have a few different here, different folks here. So I'm going to pray and then hand straight over to Peter as we talk about this really important subject. So thank you. Father, we thank you for your goodness and grace and mercy to us. We thank you that you are the God who has created us and sustains us and provides for us. We thank you that you are the God of life and truth and justice. Lord, and we look to you this evening. We look to you to be our guide, to speak to us, to bring clarity and conviction. Lord Jesus, we pray that you would minister to our own hearts on this difficult subject that perhaps we're confused about, perhaps we're seeking wisdom about, we're wondering what this means for our society and for our future. Lord, for some of us, this perhaps hits very close to home. For ourselves personally, or people we know and love in our lives. And so, Lord, we ask that you would minister to each heart here to comfort, to bring peace, as well as a deeper understanding of what your word is teaching us, and how then we can react and respond to this in public life and among those we love so dearly. So please help us. And especially Peter, we thank you for him. We thank you for his gifting here and his thinking that he's done on this, and the way he and Care are seeking to help churches like these represented tonight in serving and blessing the church and helping us to think about and engage on issues like assisted suicide. So thank you for Pete, and help him tonight as he shares his presentation, as he answers our questions. Lord, give him tremendous wisdom and insight to know how to answer and how to help us specifically, we pray. Lord Jesus, we thank you that in you we have tremendous hope for the future, whatever the future may be. Ultimately, we have deep hope in you, O Lord, and that one day you will make all things new and there will be no more death. This will no longer be a question we ever have to wrestle with at all. There will be no more death. You're the one who's defeated it forever and ever. And so we rejoice and praise you for that hope that you have given to us. Draw near now, Lord, our Saviour, because we ask it in your name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Dan. Thank you, Jamie. And thank you all for coming. It's great to see you all this evening. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Carey, wrote to MPs last year to say that supporting assisted suicide is a profoundly Christian thing to do. So the full quote is this: it is profoundly Christian to do all we can to ensure nobody suffers against their wishes. And I think that sums up some of the well-meaning confusion in some parts of the church. As Christians, we can find ourselves in a strange position when it comes to assisted suicide. And that's because the other side, the pro-assisted suicide lobby, they use a lot of words that Christians also use. Welcome, come in, take a seat. So, for example, assisted suicide, it's framed as being a compassionate approach. And as Christians, we want to say, well, yes, compassion, we love compassion. And the arguments framed in terms of compassion, they pull at our hearts. Or another word is dignity. And that the Voluntary Euthanasia Society rebranded themselves a few years ago as Dignity in Dying. And as Christians, we heartily believe in human dignity. We're always talking about the dignity of every person made in the image of God. And so when the argument is framed in terms of compassion or dignity, it can leave us wondering, well, maybe there is something to this. And there are many people who think, I know assisted suicide is supposed to be bad, but I kind of see where they're coming from. And many times after I've spoken on this topic, someone will come and tell me about a relative who's died in great pain, and that's why they're in favour of assisted suicide, because they wouldn't wish that on anyone. And if that's you, I'll be honest, I completely understand that perspective. And tonight, what we're going to do is we're just going to look at the whole thing from a Christian perspective. Let me just give you an outline for where we're going. I'll start with an intro to care, and then we'll look at the current story in Parliament. Just what's being proposed, what the arguments being put forward, where have we got to so far? And as we do that, of course, I should say we're going to cover some really harrowing, sensitive material. I don't know what's happening in your life. I don't know what you've been through, but I really encourage you, if tonight is painful for you, then do chat to me afterwards or your pastor. I'm sure they'd love to walk alongside you. But once we've looked at the current story in Parliament, we'll shift to get positive, because as Christians, we don't only want to say what we're against, but also what we're for. Now, talking about some of the negatives of assisted suicide, that's the easy bit. The hard bit is talking about why God's way is better and what that looks like. So the better story from the church, your part in the story, how you can respond, and we'll have time for discussion as we go. Q&A and prayer at the end, and a break halfway through. So that's the broad outline of this evening. And please do save up your questions. I look forward to them a bit later. But let's just start at the top. Let me tell you a little bit about CARE so you know where I'm coming from. CARE stands for Christian Action, Research and Education. It's a great name because it captures what we're all about. We do what we do because we care for people. We're not about political parties or factions or partisan games. The downside of being called CARE is it's a nightmare to search for on Google. You end up with care homes in your local area. And we often get confused with Care for the Family or Caring for Life or Care International and probably others. So who are we? We are a Christian charity looking to bring a biblical perspective into politics. We're based in Westminster. We're about here on the map, on the picture. We're about 5 minutes walk from Parliament, which means we're on the ground working there with MPs. And our mission is to see politics renewed and lives transformed. We think politics matters. We think it matters to God. We think it can make a difference in people's lives. We think politics is one way we can love our neighbours. And our story begins back in the 70s, 1971. It was just after the 60s and society had changed in many ways, and the reality was that many Christians had disengaged with politics. We've got the legacy of, you know, Wilberforce and all those others who brought so much social change, but at that time, Christians had withdrawn from engaging with the lawmakers of our society. And so in 1971, this huge event was organised, the Nationwide Festival of Light. That the central event was there in London, 45,000 Christians in Trafalgar Square. They'd come from all over the country with banners displaying slogans like moral pollution needs a solution. We've worked on our marketing and slogans since then. And then they went to Hyde Park and had an open-air concert, and Graham Kendrick led the worship. The gospel was preached. From all I've heard, it was quite something. But in the days leading up to the Nationwide Festival of Light, there had been beacons lit at 300 sites around the country. I think of it a bit like the fires of Gondor in Lord of the Rings, if you've ever seen that. And 100,000 Christians went to those beacons. And out of it all was born this movement that involved prayer and petitions and writing to MPs and meeting with them. Fast forward from 71 to 1983, the Nationwide Festival of Light changed its name to CARE. And so we had our 40th anniversary service about 2 years ago. And what do you know, Graham Kendrick was leading the worship there as well. Three main things we do. Number one, we equip politicians. So over those decades, we've cultivated close relationships with MPs in the Commons and peers in the House of Lords. We give them briefing, we do briefings, we do research, we prepare reports, we write speeches, we'll even write legislation or amendments to legislation that they can then submit in Parliament. A lot of it's behind the scenes, working on a range of issues from online safety to assisted suicide to freedom of belief for gender and conversion therapy. We work across the political spectrum. Our CEO has stood as a Labour candidate. Our head of policy is a former Conservative MP. So that's the first thing we do. We equip politicians. Secondly, we engage the church. That's what I'm all about. We want to help churches and Christians engage in politics in ways that are healthy and biblically faithful. So we provide resources. There's a whole suite of resources over there. Please do help yourself. It's all free. We've got topic guides on how to write to your MP, or more detail on all about assisted suicide. There's biblical deep dives on gender or old age. And our most popular resource is our prayer diary. People say it's really good for helping them to pray for our nation in a varied and informed way. So do help yourself to anything on the table. And lastly, we empower future leaders. So we're not only interested in politics today, but also politics tomorrow. And every year we have between 12 and 15 university graduates who we then place in Parliament with politicians. So they work for their MP 4 days, and then every Friday they come to us for in-depth training or teaching or whatever else. And over the years, we've had about 400 graduates go through that leadership programme. Encouragingly for us, three of those 400, they're now MPs. Two were elected last summer. They've been doing the job for just over a year. So that's what we're all about, empowering future leaders. And sometimes I get asked, and in fact I was asked this in the car on the way here by Dan, what makes you different? And so I just want to talk about what I love most about CARE, and that's our emphasis on grace and truth. We've built our reputation not only on parliamentary expertise, but also for the way we speak. It's putting truth and grace at the heart of all our communications and action. Because it's how we speak, how we raise awareness among our supporters, how we interact with those who disagree with us. It's as important as what we do. And we don't always get it right, but we are always keeping it in mind and trying to get better. And so often we find people thank us for the tone we adopt. And at the end, I'm going to ask you whether you would consider signing up to CARE and joining our mailing list. We don't bombard you, just a weekly email, a Christian update from Parliament. And if you sign up, that really helps our policy team. Because when they go into meetings with MPs, one of the first things they're asked is how many people are on your database? How many people are you in touch with? And they're asking that because they're always thinking ahead to the next election. They want to know, well, how influential is this group? How many people are listening to them? And the more people on our list, the more weight we carry in those meetings, the more we can do on behalf of the church. And you can follow us on social media as well. So do chat to me afterwards if you'd like to know more about CARE. That's the CARE bit out of the way. Now let's shift to our topic and let's have a break from my voice and listen to what you've got to say. And here's our first question. Why do you think support for assisted suicide has risen in recent years? So there's been people campaigning on this for a century. So why is it now that the Yes campaign is winning? Take 3 or 4 minutes, chat about it in groups of whatever number you like, and then we'll feedback in a few minutes to see what you come up with.
I think the question itself strikes me. It's like, yes, it has risen, hasn't it, support? So the question itself, I think, yeah.
I think people have grown more accustomed to it as an idea, and that stigma has gone now. It's almost become, it's like some other things, actually fighting with abortion, where it's taboo, you don't talk about it. It's a very shameful thing. It's almost become like a badge of honour for people now. People are facing, you're taking control, you're making your choice. So all power to you, and I think that's what it's come out of. It's that, as that's grown in culture, that sense of autonomy, personal choice, independence. That's really what people are. That's the idol, isn't it? And so if anything looks like that, more power to you. What if that's the idol? But as cultures become more like
there's been a rise in secularism, generally. There's a rise in consumerism, and I think that has sort of torn people without realizing it. Like, they should not suffer. Comfort is what we are. We should have comfort at any cost, but nothing should be so obvious. This acceptance actually is part of what we've done, coupled with the idea of self autonomy.
I'm going to give you another 30 seconds.
Why would you carry on suffering from these
issues. It's like it's a very Western thing, then, isn't it, really? Because in the West, we're so comfortable, we've got medicines on ourselves. We've built a society that is geared towards comfort, not towards suffering. And so, why is it not the case in other people where suffering is a daily part of life? You know, they're not necessarily thinking about it.
Okay, from the sound of things, I know you could keep going. But also, I know that we don't want tonight to go on for 3 hours. So we're going to curtail that there. And I would love to get some feedback. I was overhearing some good answers. But anyone want to share what was shared in your groups? That'd be really helpful. So stick a hand in the air. Yes, at the back.
I was going to say, so I've worked in palliative care. So my speciality was leukemia. So bone marrow transplants and leukemia. And one of the biggest issues that I think with assisted suicide, and I think for me as a Christian, where we're approaching this wrong, the reason why it's gone up through these years is because of loneliness.
Yeah.
People who are dying are watching these clocks tick, they're in absolute agony, and they know they don't have family or they don't have friends turning up. And so the question you have to ask yourself is like, you know you have a terminal disease, you're going to die, you're in absolute agony, you can't breathe. Someone offers you an extra syringe of morphine or something like that, would you take it?
And that's,
I think,
the thing.
A lot of people would ask themselves the question when you were in that situation, whether they would do it. I mean, Saul did it in Samuel 1:31, right?
No, we're going to come to that, yeah. and so I think that's really insightful, the loneliness and suffering interplay, because so often we can cope more with suffering when we've got people around us who love us. And loneliness, it makes it worse, doesn't it? And if we can help one, if we can deal with the loneliness to some extent, that doesn't remove suffering, but it helps people to bear suffering.
Yeah. Because they have something to live for.
Yeah.
You know, when they have the family, the children, the friends, they have that distraction, they have something to live for. That, you know, it was from a personal perspective, one of the reasons why my mom ended up hanging on for so long was because she wanted to see my niece's birthday. You know, she died on the 5th of November, but actually wasn't. And there were times, I mean, she was in such pain and agony but I would have taken that syringe and probably would have pumped her full of it if I had the option. Mm. And that's I think that's what it comes down to. And I think when you have a group of people who are looking after you, who are caring for you, and sometimes, and this is for me a little bit sometimes, I hate sometimes, as it says in James 1:17, you know, pure religion is this, to seek God with all your heart, but also to visit the fatherless and the widow. And this is sometimes where I sit there with Christians, when I sat there and I was lonely, we'll pray for you. I don't want prayer, I want fellowship.
Yes.
Right? That's where sometimes...
That's spot on. I'm going to stop you there because I feel like you're rushing ahead and we're going to cover what Christians can do to help people who are suffering later. But I'd love maybe a few others, yeah.
One factor that came out in our group was that there's been probably a normalization of this is much more acceptable these days because you've got Netherlands, Canada, and other countries that have rolled out the process. And
we're seeing it in other countries and ignoring maybe some of the horror stories and things, but it's almost the idea of this is progress. Progress is a one-way street, and if they've walked down that street, then we're going to have to walk down that street. Over here.
We sort of landed on it being quite a Western issue in terms of, you know, we're more nihilistic, so maybe life doesn't have as much meaning and what's the point anyway. But also a culture of comfort and ease, and everything's about eliminating suffering. And so we haven't got any place in our thinking and worldview for any kind of suffering. And so it's sort of a Westernite, much more of a Western idea in that sense, you know, that has made room for it, I think, and that's part of it.
I think that's spot on. It's Westernized nations that have legalized this, and it's really tied to affluence and comfort. And in fact, if you look at the way the vote landed across in Parliament and the different people who voted for it versus against it, often it was those in the most deprived communities and those who represented communities with more ethnic minorities that voted against it. And it was those in the more affluent, privileged communities who more voted for it, which think it's there. Should we have one more briefly? Anyone else had another? There's so many answers here, but yeah.
I think it, to some extent, it's an economic thing in that, you know, we're all living longer and care home costs are appalling and, you know, there's this feeling that, you know, there's this feeling that you're going to be a burden on your children sort of thing.
And that's absolutely right. And no one wants to be a burden. And we'll come to that later.
Yeah.
But no one wants to be the burden on their children.
This thing about it being a Western idea, I was talking, it was when this bill was first being talked about some years ago, I was talking to an elderly Indian lady, and she said to me, and I mean, I don't know if her opinion was typical at all, or what part of India she came from, she said to me, I don't see what all the fuss is about. She said, when people in India know they're getting too old, they can buy poison in the market and they take the decision for themselves.
And maybe, I don't know anything about that. It certainly is, it's not legal there. So if you look at the countries,
well,
it's been legalised.
It probably isn't, but, you know, this lady said, you know, that people choose not to be a burden to their families. And there are ways of doing it in their culture, you know.
Interesting. Let's keep moving through. Just want to now update you on where we've got to in Parliament. So on Friday the 20th of June, the 314 MPs voted in favour of the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, and 291 voted against. And so the bill passed what was called its third reading, and now it's in the House of Lords. And in the Lords, it's had second reading, which passed without a vote. That's normal. We've got a select committee which is currently examining the bill line by line, taking evidence, hearing from key stakeholders. November and December in the House of Lords will be what's called committee stage. That's 4 days of debating possible amendments to the bill, and then they will vote, the Lords will vote for the first time probably early next year in what's called third reading. And I'll say up front, that is likely to pass. The best opportunity we had to defeat it was in the Commons. But we are working with our allies in the Lords, A, to stop the bill, and B, if it's going to pass, we want to make it the least bad bill possible. So we'll get back to what you can do at the end. But as we look at this, it's really important to be clear on what exactly it is we're talking about, because in Parliament there's been quite a lot of argument and discussion about language, and this is a deliberate tactic, I think. There's been a blurring of language and words used to obscure the reality of what's going on. Slightly reminds me of the Humpty Dumpty quote from Alice in Wonderland. When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean. Nothing more and nothing less. So let me give you an example. One campaigner said to MPs in Parliament with a straight face, assisted dying is a form of suicide prevention. Or a pro-assisted MP, talking about coercion, said the most coercion that happens is with relatives trying to talk loved ones out of having an assisted death. That's the coercion we need to be worried about, apparently. Oh, I think we're being told up is down and down is up. There's a stat that says 84% of the public support assisted dying, but it's really misleading because in follow-up questions, it becomes clear that most people are unaware of what assisted dying actually is. Lots of them think it's an overlap with palliative care, and once it's explained, the figure drops from 84% in favour to 43%. So definitions matter. Euthanasia is where a doctor administers a lethal dose of drugs with the intention of ending a person's life. Assisted suicide is similar, but the difference is that here the doctor provides the lethal drug, but the patient administers it themselves. So the doctor's still heavily involved, the doctor assists the suicide, but doesn't take the final act. That's what's being proposed in the UK. And campaigners will say, well, assisted dying is different to assisted suicide because it's for someone who's got less than 6 months left to live. They're dying anyway, but it's the same act as assisted suicide. The medic still hands the drug to the patient. The patient still uses it to end his or her life. So at CARE, we always try to talk about assisted suicide. That's the phrase I'm going to use tonight. That's how I'd urge you to refer to it as well. We think words matter. And lastly, on terminology, I want to make clear that euthanasia and assisted suicide, they're very different from the decision to withdraw medical treatment. Sometimes this gets mixed up in the debate. Maybe stopping certain medication or turning off life support or a do not resuscitate order. You know, done well, that's a conversation with the patient and the family and doctors, and you could reach the conclusion we've done all we can, so we're going to let this disease take its course. We're going to focus on managing your pain, and some people merge that with the assisted suicide debate as if there's no big difference. But there's all the difference in the world between giving lethal barbiturates designed to paralyze your nervous system and kill you, and stopping a treatment we were previously giving. And as this has, those are definitions, as this has gone through Parliament, we've heard three main stories, three main arguments from those in favour of assisted suicide. Three main arguments. And the first one is this, it's that we need it. You could call this the compassion argument. Yeah, based on the unimaginable suffering that some people are going through. So listen to this. It's a story from a lady named Heather. It's on the Dignity and Dying website. She said, "My mum was 79 when she died from cancer. The radiotherapy treatment had left her with third-degree burns, so lying down was particularly painful. She was so sore sitting down that she would eat standing up until doctors found a tumour blocking her stomach. She spent her final week in hospital. She couldn't digest food, she couldn't take fluids by mouth. She was in constant pain from the radiation burns and the tumours and all the tubes she was dealing with. She could no longer even speak. And she would regularly hold two fingers to her mouth in the motion of a gun. My mum had a great life and an absolutely horrible death." And again, stories like that are told in favour of a change in the law. And it's the right question, isn't it? People rightly want to alleviate, to end this suffering. And so they say, in the name of compassion, we need the law to change. But what's wrong with the "we need it" argument? Well, the reality is that ending the life of the sufferer is not the right response to deep suffering. We need something else, and when we need better investment in palliative care, which is looking to help people prepare for death and die well. Palliative care was pioneered as a medical discipline by a Christian, Dame Cicely Saunders, and she had a really positive vision for the end of life. She said, "You matter because you are you. You matter until the last moment of your life, and we will do all we can to make that life as good as we can." And when it's properly funded, palliative care does wonders. In most cases, with properly funded hospice care, pain can be managed and death can be dignified. We know it doesn't eliminate all suffering, but the stories we're hearing in the news at the moment about how awful palliative care is, I think in some level it does a disservice to the amazing work that many palliative care nurses do. It does need more investment. It's a little bit of a postcode lottery at the moment, and at CARE we've campaigned on this for years, but that's another reason not to legislate for assisted suicide. Because in every other country that's legalised it, funding for palliative care has dropped afterwards. So there's the first strand of the argument we've been hearing. It's all about compassion, but we think true compassion should lead you in a different direction, to give better care right to the end of life. The second strand of argument that was heard in the debate is that we should legalise assisted suicide because we want it. The autonomy argument. I think I overheard you talking about that there. Why shouldn't we be able to choose when we die? I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Say I don't believe in God. Who are you to deny me the right? It's the right to end my life in the time and way of my choosing. And autonomy and choice, they're good things, aren't they? In almost every area of life, we do have choice. We have choices about who to marry and where to live and what work to do. We have freedom to refuse or accept certain medical treatments. But in today's post-Christian world, autonomy and choice have become distorted. That they're now seen as ultimate rather than just good things given to us by God. It's why the words choice or choose were used 128 times in the parliamentary debate. My choice has now become king. And that means that autonomy and choice, they're really difficult things to argue against. You sound really narrow and restrictive. But we limit choice all the time, don't we? I'm not free to do anything I want, certainly without legal consequence, because we limit autonomy at times in the interests of public safety. I'm not free to take certain illegal drugs. I'm not free to sell a kidney to the highest bidder, even if they have the money and I'm willing to give it. I'm not free to fight Dan to the death in a duel, even if we both wanted to.
Yeah,
but we can't, because our autonomy is restricted by the government. We restrict freedom because your actions impact others and they shape the society we live in. And it's not just about giving choice to some people to end their lives if they want to. But now, if this is passed, when this is passed, everyone with a terminal illness will have to ask, and maybe will be asked by their doctor, whether they want this. And they'll have to consider, am I being selfish by continuing to live? Am I taking up NHS resources that could be used for someone else? Am I a burden on my family? Everyone with a terminal illness will now need to answer those questions, because it's not just giving a choice to the select few, it's asking everyone to make a choice, and then you get the unspoken pressure that comes with that choice. Self-coercion, if you like. Journalist Matthew Paris wrote in the Times last year in favour of assisted suicide, and he made a prediction. He said, social and cultural pressure will grow on the terminally ill to hasten their own deaths. Your time is up will never be an order, but it may one day be the kind of unspoken hint that everybody understands. And he says that's a good thing, incidentally. But taking the decision out of God's hands and putting it in ours, it's a recipe for disaster, and it's what happens when you legalize assisted suicide. There are other unintended consequences. It changes certain dynamics in healthcare. Cost will become a bigger factor in whether treatment is available. So your autonomy impacts others there. Mental health. Evidence shows that when assisted suicide is legalized in a country, unassisted suicides also increase. So giving people a choice affects others again. Or care home costs. One of Britain's biggest care home trusts wrote to Parliament and said, it is without question that some people will consider assisted suicide in order to protect the financial prospects of their loved ones, not because they wish to die. That want to die, but they're thinking, I should do this. Your choice impacts others. Or disabilities. There's a documentary on iPlayer by Liz Carr called Better Off Dead. She says, as long as there is deep inequality and certain people's lives are viewed as less valuable, then to have state-assisted death isn't safe for the likes of me and other disabled people. Every disability group stands against a change in the law. And again, saying autonomy isn't sufficient because your choice impacts others. The argument falls down because no man is an island. Before we take a break, there's one more strand to the argument in favour of assisted suicide. We heard people saying we need it. We've heard people saying we want it. The last thing you heard in Parliament is that we can control it. So campaigners say, look, we recognise this is something that could be open to abuse if not done properly. We've heard the stories from other nations, but we've got it right. If we do this our way, the law won't be abused, it won't be misused, it won't be a slippery slope. We've been told this law has the strictest safeguards in the world. I wonder if you heard that soundbite. There are two problems with it. One is that it's not true, and the other is that even if it were true, those safeguards would get eroded over time. With safeguards, one is that this procedure is only for those with less than 6 months left to live, but predicting how long someone has to live, it's a notoriously difficult business, isn't it? Plenty of stories about people who are still living 5, 10, 20 years later. Another safeguard's around the process for approving a request. There was originally a High Court judge needing to be involved. That's been dropped already. We're told there's now a panel, which will be a better safeguard. But these panels, they'll become a rubber stamp exercise. They can be done by audio call, like by phone call, not in person or even a video call. So there's no way they're going to spot coercion if you're just having a quick phone chat. No requirement for the panel to actually ask any questions. No power of summons. So if they suspected that there was coercion, they can't force anybody to come and give evidence to the panel. It's not a strong safeguard. Here's a safeguard that doesn't exist. It was voted down by MPs. In Australia, doctors aren't allowed to raise the subject with patients first. Precisely because of that subtle unspoken pressure that comes when someone in authority says you might want to think about ending your life. In the UK bill, a doctor can approach a vulnerable patient and suggest just that. We managed to get one amendment in the Commons, which said that the doctor can't raise it with under 18s. What happens if the family thinks that someone's facing pressure? Is there a safeguard there? No. In fact, an amendment saying family had to be informed didn't make it to a vote. There was an incident in Belgium 5 or 6 years ago where a woman in her 60s was euthanized because she was struggling with depression. And the first her son heard about it was when the hospital called to ask what he wanted to do with her remains. So no, these aren't the strictest safeguards in the world, but even the safeguards we have are likely to get weaker, not stronger over time, whether through amendments to the law, it's happened in every other country that's legalized it, or interpretation of the law, that's happened in every other country that's legalized it. And in some countries, through turning a blind eye to the law, ignoring perhaps certain reporting restrictions, or selectively following the rules, or finding ways to get someone through the hoops of the criteria, even though they don't strictly qualify. In the Netherlands, the law started with having an incurable illness causing unbearable suffering, and now people are euthanized for loneliness or autism. In Canada, there's growing popular support now to introduce euthanasia for the homeless. Kill them rather than help them. There's going to be expansion of the criteria because any limits are, by their nature, arbitrary. Because once you agree to the principle that it's okay to take some people's lives, why are you saying yes to them and no to them? I think there's an institutional arrogance that says we won't go down the slope. All sorts of other problems with the bill. I won't list them all. Like I say, we're working in the Lord's. We're praying to the Lord. But we do need to start to think about how we live as churches and Christians in a world where this has been legalized. Humanly speaking, this is going to happen. So we need to start thinking, well, how do we tell a better story about God's plan for life and death? How can we help doctors and nurses who are trying to care for patients in that environment? How do we protect those in our congregations or maybe other family members who are feeling pressured either by others or by themselves? And what do we do when family members tell us they plan on having assisted suicide for themselves? We need to start thinking not only, oh, what's bad about this law, but also what's good about God's way. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to take a little break. And during the break, I'm going to ask you to discuss a question. And here it is. If assisted suicide is legalized, what do churches need to do? A, in the first few years, and B, over the next 30 years. This is a really broad question. I want you to think outside the box. What can we do about it? Please do think about that for a few minutes. I have no idea what the arrangements for drinks
are. Do tea and coffee now, yeah.
Tea and coffee now, but I don't know. Go to the hatch.
Yeah, people can come to the hatch.
We'll start back again in about 10 minutes, something like that, and I'll see what you came up with, either in your groups or by yourselves. It is, yeah. Well, you've still got 1 minute, but you've all gone quiet, so let's start. What sort of answers did you... Let's start with the... You're allowed through, yeah. Come through. First half of the question first. What sort of answers did people come up with? I'm really interested in this because we're trying to think about this at CARE. And we're coming up with ideas, but I want to hear from other people as well. So who wants to venture a response? At the back, yeah.
We need to normalise death.
Normalise death.
And we need
go
to make
on.
People, but basically what it is, we need to make people educationally aware of what death is. We've sterilised, we've taken it away from society.
Yeah.
And I think actually, death used to be where people used to be surrounded by family and friends and watch people die. You know, and actually, if you speak to a lot of palliative nurses, a lot of what we see as troubling and painful and stuff like that actually isn't.
Mm. Yes, I've heard that from other palliative nurses. Yeah.
It's really distressing to see, but actually the person doesn't feel it.
Yeah.
And the body knows how to die appropriately.
Yeah, I've heard that from other palliative care nurses as well. It's, you know, when you haven't seen death at all and you see it, you end up really distressed. But they're saying, no, this is not that. This person is not distressed. This is just what the body looks like when it's going through those last moments. And so normalising that, de-sterilising it or de-sanitising it, whichever word you used, I think that is a big thing. And yeah, again, how we do that, I'm not sure, but I think that's an important thing to be doing. What? Some more answers.
Help with loneliness, if you think loneliness is being a driver for it.
Yeah. What do we do to help with loneliness?
Time.
Yes. I love that. Especially, I think, I've lived in a few different places across the UK, and my general perception is the closer I have been to London, the less time people have. I'm now in Woking, which is probably not much different from Reading to London, Woking to London. And, you know, people are busy, aren't they? And actually giving someone some time is one of the best gifts you can give them. You know, when I lived in a rural village in Wales, this was not a challenge. But here it is. Yeah, loneliness. Let's really look to see how we can love people well. Anything else?
I think just, I don't know the answer, but something the church will have to do is figure out how they deal with someone in the church whose close family member is proceeding with this, irrespective of feedback. Or even how you respond to a Christian who is going to go ahead with it.
I was chatting on Monday with the head of the Christian Medical Fellowship in Canada. Actually, it's not in Canada, it's not the Christian Medical Fellowship, it's the Christian Medical and Dental Fellowship, which I learnt. And we're just chatting about an event we're planning for pastors next year and some of the challenges pastors are going to face. And he was telling me about a pastor who had someone in his congregation said, I'm going to go for an assisted suicide. And he's trying to urge them against it, or euthanasia in Canada. He was urging them against it. And they said, I am doing this. And then they said, and I've got two requests of you. Firstly, can you help me plan the funeral? And can you sit with me when I die? How do you begin to think about that? So yeah, we're going to need to help church leaders think, how are we going to deal with some of these pastoral questions? And I don't think there's simple answers. Anyone else? Yes.
Yeah, I think as well, kind of leading on from what Michael said on this area, with those that we know are vulnerable, whether it's through age or any other situation that they are facing, we need to make sure that we help with the connection, like with the whole church family, but with them individually. We need to know. I know from my experience, I'm now a trained chaplain, but I've worked in hospice, and I see that is one of the things that people most crave is connection,
yeah.
And to help them to understand who they are and their value as a person.
Yeah, I absolutely love that answer. It's that same theme again, isn't it?
I have one question.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Just quickly, how can a company, how can we as a society, and this is where it's total cognitive, we refuse to sell legalized drugs for the death penalty, but for some reason it's okay to legalize murder people who are on assisted suicide?
So, great question. I think if I were to put myself in a different camp and answer you, I would come back to autonomy. And I would say that these people are choosing to die, and so we will give them lethal drugs. The criminal is not choosing to die. In fact, that would be a punishment of death, and that would violate the principle of autonomy. So that would be the other side of the argument.
But the question is simply, like that person that killed themselves because of depression, people on cancer, when they have cancer, heart disease, they're not cognitively fully functioning. And so the question is, how can you 100% tell me that that person is doing a decision based on pure cognitive ability and not because their mind is befuddled and they've been fed all kinds of life?
Indeed, and as you look through the grieving process, as you get a terminal diagnosis, one of the parts of the grieving process is going through depression, isn't it? And
yeah.
It's almost like assisted suicide says, well, let's not get to acceptance.
Yeah.
let's stop it there.
Yeah.
And... you know, if you're lucky enough that you get onto acceptance, but you know, you get out of the depression before the date comes for your assisted death, then great. Otherwise, no. And what about in 30 years' time? So we look back and you know, imagine and say, what do we wish the church had done? Yes, at the back.
Regain something that is lost. You know, the early church, the first Christians, were known for walking towards and staying in the city to care for those that were dying.
Yeah, the plague victims.
Out of the city.
Yeah.
The deaconesses went out and picked up the babies that were left.
Yes.
That were left to die. And all the charities, even like some of that Sue Ryder, started by Christians, have just lost that faith and secularized and no longer pay for a chaplain. There's an opportunity, in a sense, for the church to regain the ground it's lost. And
there absolutely is.
And move towards offering an alternative, actively.
And I think that's so important, because at CARE, we're all about the law. Right? We're looking to resist a change of the law, and if this passes, we're going to look to reverse it. But the early Christians, that was not their primary focus. It was on, actually, let's go to them.
Mm.
Let's feed the sick, let's clothe the hungry, let's... You all know what I was trying to say, even if I don't. One more, and then let's move on.
I fear in 30 years that the church could have sort of accepted it and almost just stopped its messaging on that, you know, and given in almost, or even assimilated and imbibed some of the values and ideas. You know, you see what I mean? So right now we might be feeling it quite raw. In the next few years, it might be still quite raw. But in 30 years, I hope this isn't the case, that churches just kind of give up or stop that message. You know.
So let me tell you about one of my colleagues. His name's Tim. He married a Canadian lady, and so he's got Canadian in-laws. They are Christians. They're conservative Christians in a conservative church, and they're solid on their doctrine and their theology. Assisted suicide and euthanasia have been legal for 9 years in Canada, and they say, well, initially, they were very staunchly against it. Now, they're already accepting it and seeing it as normal and starting to say, oh, is it so bad? And I think that speaks into the way, if we're not active in saying why we think it's a problem, even solid conservative Christians can end up drifting on this issue. And I think teaching both this and the next generation is going to be important, because we're going to start swimming in this water where assisted suicide is normal in our culture and it's talked about, and there's soaps and TV shows and films about it. And unless we're actively teaching about why we think God's way is different and better, then Christians are going to start going, And so, yeah. There we go. I want to focus now on the better story the church can tell, because, you know, Christians, we've been accused of imposing our morality on this debate as if we've got this horrible restrictive mindset. But I think actually, we have a view about God and life and death that is true and good and beautiful. And so what I want to run through is five ways that we can talk to our neighbours and friends that point to actually how God's way is better. And so just five angles that you can kind of pick and choose almost as hooks to hang your thoughts on. And I'm going to run through them quickly, and we haven't done much Bible so far. We're going to do more in this section. So in the Christian story, it is a story where it is for God to give and take life. It's not a power or right he's given us, and that's actually really liberating. It's not restrictive. Hannah sings about this in 1 Samuel, the Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. We do not. This is at the heart of the sixth commandment, Exodus 20, you shall not murder. There are two instances in the Bible where someone asks another human to end their suffering in this way, and both of them are portrayed negatively. One of them is Abimelech. His story is in the book of Judges, and the general rule of thumb is that if they do it in Judges, it's not a good idea. The other's King Saul. He's mortally wounded. He asks his servant to end his suffering by running him through with a sword, but the servant refuses. Later, it gets confusing, and Amalekite claims to have done the deed, and he says, probably untruthfully, he says, Saul said, stand here and kill me because I'm in the throes of death, but I'm still alive. So I stood beside him and killed him because I knew that he could not survive. But he's not then praised for his compassion and mercy. He's condemned for his murder. Because it's for God to give and take life. And I do want us to think, how can we communicate to people that it is good? It is his kindness not to give us this responsibility. We've already talked about it. By giving some people a choice, you're pushing that choice on everyone, and choosing the moment of death, it may be a goal for some, but it's actually too heavy a burden. We may question God's timing. We may not understand God's plan, but I hope we can see God's goodness in not giving us the right to choose when life should end. It's a better way. Second better way, and that is in the Christian story, we believe every life has value. Whoever you are, you're valuable because you're made in the image of God. You may be disabled. You may be suffering. Your best years may be behind you, but the Lord himself has crowned you with glory and honour. And in fact, those who are seen as weaker are to be shown greater honour and dignity in God's economy. So we say, whoever you are, you have something to offer us. You're a part of us. And the message of assisted suicide, it's not how it would be put in the arguments, but this is the underlying message. It's that it is good for some people. It would be good for them not to exist. Due to the circumstances they're in, it would be good for their life to be over. And the knock-on effect of that, and again, this may not be people's intention, but the knock-on effect is it leads us to begin reducing the value of some people's lives in our minds. And it brings to the forefront the thought that if I was in your shoes, I wouldn't want to live. It's so depressing. I've mentioned already, in some countries that have legalised assisted suicide, popular support has risen for expanding it to the homeless or to drug addicts or to the disabled. And that's because the law is a teacher. And this kind of law reinforces the idea that there is a category of lives that should be ended. And the only question is which lives we put into that box. But Christians, we can always be confident to say the opposite. Nobody's ever passed their sell-by date. Mm. Everyone has value. You matter because you are you, and you matter to the last moment of your life. A third angle to talk about is that in the Christian story, we bear one another's burdens. There's a video on our YouTube channel called Tony's Story. It's an interview with our former CEO, Nola, telling of how her husband, Tony, died from Alzheimer's in 2017. And I'd really recommend it. It's brutally honest. But one thing Nola said stuck with me, and it's that I'm so proud that I cared for him every step of the way. Yeah, there were times she talks about how hard the suffering was, but through it all, she got to bear his burdens, as she had once vowed to do. And we come into this world as burdens. We leave the world as burdens at various times in our lives. We bear one another's burdens. Let's commit here and now. Let's commit to be a people who never say to that horrendous phrase to one another, I don't want to be a burden. I'll tell you about Rosina from Canada. She had fibromyalgia, various psychiatric disorders, really low level of disability benefits, so she couldn't afford proper pain medication or proper housing. She applied for euthanasia. She wasn't technically eligible, but she was granted it anyway. She was killed within a few days. And later a friend found a note from her, and it said, "The suffering I experience is mental, not physical. And if more people cared about me, I would be able to handle the suffering caused by my physical illness alone." If there had been more people to bear her burdens. So Christians, let's be people who do that, who spend time with people, who love the elderly, the lonely, the suffering. And yes, that's sacrifice and that's costly in our busy world, but what we want for them is to choose life, not death. And when they have connection, that's easier to do. In the Christian story, we stand up for the vulnerable, we care for the vulnerable. Proverbs 31 tells us to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. I don't know if you've ever heard people say, you know, Christians shouldn't impose their morality. This was a massive theme of some of the debates in Parliament, and great outrage was caused as people were accused of smuggling hidden religious agendas into the debate and all sorts. And the thing is, all sorts of areas I won't try to impose my morality on people. I won't try and impose my beliefs on people. But when it comes to standing up for the vulnerable, I'll impose them all day long. I'm not ashamed of that. It was Christians seeking to impose their morality that ended the gladiatorial games. It was Christians imposing their morality that means children don't work in factories anymore. Christians were imposing their morality, ended the slave trade. So, and if our morality tells us every life should be protected and valued and honoured, and we're being asked somehow in public debate to feel ashamed of that, well, I think we need to tell a story where Christians, we feel proud and confident to say, no, we'll stand up for the vulnerable. That's what the church is for. One more way I think we can focus on the better story that Christians believe, and that's that we can give people hope. So let me tell you about Alison. Alison suffered throughout her life, born with spina bifida, she used a wheelchair, she was doubly incontinent, constantly nauseous, had osteoporosis, so lots of broken bones, and she had frequent infections. And she said sometimes the pain was so bad that she couldn't move or speak or even think. And at one point in her 30s, Alison was given a diagnosis of less than 6 months left to live. And she says, oh, she wished assisted suicide had been legal then because she would have taken it. This was back in the 80s, but she said she was hopeless. Alison's physical suffering never got better. but she found a will to live after visiting a project for disabled children in southern India. She ended up setting up a charity. She went on to support hundreds of disabled children and young adults. They all called her Mummy Allison. And she later commented, had assisted suicide been legal, I would have missed the best years of my life. She lived another 20 years after that 6-month diagnosis. But even when that isn't the case, when it is a decline unto death, hope is still important. Christian hope, of course, is that this life is not all there is, that eternity awaits and a new suffering-free body. Think about Job. Job goes through horrendous suffering, doesn't he? An incredibly successful man, prosperous, rich, everything going for him, but then in one chapter of the book, almost within the same day, I think it is, disaster after disaster befalls him, and he goes through some bleak moments. Chapter 6, he longs for God to take his life. He says, "Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut off my life." Well, chapter 7, verse 3, he says how pointless everything is. He says, "I have been allotted months of futility and nights of misery." And in chapter 7, verse 7, it's despair. He says, "My eyes will never see happiness again." That's what it feels like when you're suffering. You can't imagine a future where things are better than they are today. And the desire for assisted suicide, it's so often tied up with a lack of hope that things will ever get better. That's Job 7. What does he say just 12 chapters later? "I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end he will stand on the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes. I am not another." So he's gone from "my eyes will never see happiness again" to "my eyes will see God." See, assisted suicide, it feeds on hopelessness, and that this is all there is, and it's only going to get worse. And it says, in your moment of hopelessness, when you've just had that terminal diagnosis and when you can't see a way out, we're going to let you go. No, we're going to help you go. But Christians, we can tell a story of hope. We can tell the promise that one day he will wipe every tear from every eye and there'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. For the old order of things has passed away. And until that day, we can say to people, "We will sit by your side and offer you hope. And when you can't hope for yourself, we will hope for you." So Christians, I do think we have some positive things we can say into the world in this debate. Let's have confidence to do that. In a moment, we'll have time for questions, but very briefly, I just want to talk about your part in the story. And there are three things we're asking you to do. Number one is to write to, not your MP anymore, write to peers in the House of Lords. So we're used to writing to our MP, that the Lords, they can seem a bit more distant and disconnected, but if you go onto the CARE website, front page, there is the first article, it's like, click here for how to write to the Lords. And we've got a list of peers we think it would be worth writing to, a list of arguments to make in your own words. So we encourage you, write letters to them, write letters full of grace and truth and overflowing with the fruit of the Spirit. Number one, write. Number two is pray. Proverbs 21 tells us that in the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water. Your MP's heart, a stream of water. I was saying to someone in the break, I'm delighted that the central Reading MPs all voted against this. That's great. But we also know that every peer in the House of Lords has a heart that God can turn. And when Daniel and his friends faced those great trials in Babylon, what did they do? They prayed. I said tonight, we think this is going to pass, but we also believe in the God of the book of Esther, don't we? The God who was able to turn expected political outcomes on their head. 180-degree reversal just based on one night one king's inability to sleep. So pray for Parliament, pray for the Lords, pray for your MP, pray for those involved in the campaign on both sides. Pray for those who are suffering and those who lack hope. Pray for those who are vulnerable and fearful of this change in the law. Pray for us at CARE and our work. And lastly, love.
Mm.
And that's a summary of what we've said already. Love your neighbour. This passes, let's think more and more about how we do that in the ordinary ways, in creative ways, as individuals, as churches, maybe individual churches, maybe churches grouping together. What can we do? Let me finish with a Bible verse and then a quote. Daniel's friends went into the fiery furnace saying that God was able to save them. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. God can defeat this vote. But even if he does not, let us get on with serving him faithfully and loving our neighbour. Bible verse and then a quote. Stanley Hauerwas is an American theologian and he writes, I say in 100 years, if Christians are known as a strange group of people who don't kill their children and don't kill the elderly, we would have done a great thing. That may not sound like much. But if we can be a community who, through the worship of God, is willing to be hospitable to new life and life that is suffering, then that is a political alternative that otherwise the world will not have. Thank you for your time and attention. I think it's 7:30. I think that was the time I finished, aimed to finish, but then we had some tea and coffee in the middle, which is why it's slightly behind, because I'd love to do 5-10 minutes of questions. So if anyone has any questions, let's do that now, and then we can close shortly. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to ask, would you mind going back to the better story slide? What would you say, on the first 2 points in particular, what would you say to someone who challenged it, say, perhaps you're being a little bit selective, because actually there are circumstances where the Bible allows for the taking of life, or Christians may champion someone, say, you know, equivalent of taking a bullet for somebody, you know, giving up that life, facing inevitable death to save someone else.
Yeah,
you know, so it's like, well, it's not always the case that death is out of our hands.
No, absolutely, and I think I once had a question in a previous version of this talk. You know, can you give any examples of assisted suicide in the Bible? And someone and kind of raised it to, would you include Jesus? Yeah. I think no, I wouldn't. I think sacrificing your life for someone else, I would put in a different category there. I think that you are not ending your life because you want to, but it is an act of love for someone else who would otherwise die. And I think there is a distinction there. And I think I could probably put it better than that, but I think most people would agree with that, and I think someone who argued that would probably be being a little bit disingenuous. I'm not saying you are. I think the other one is actually a stronger argument, and that would be, well, there are times that we are in favour, we could be in favour of taking of life, or the Bible is, and that's with judicial punishment. So, you know, someone takes a life, the Bible says, well, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and you know, Genesis 9:6, you should take the life of the one who killed a man. And I think the distinction there is that God has given very explicitly the sword of justice to governments. You've got that in Genesis 9:6. You see that played out through the Old Testament. You've got it in Romans 13, that God gives the sword to governments. So he is very explicitly giving them authority to take life in certain circumstances. Whereas he never gives the sword to individuals, either for individualized justice, like vengeance, or to do something like we've talked about tonight. And I think that plays into the distinction you get in the Old Testament between killing and murder. Whereas the commandment is you shall not murder, there are times when God does give the authority to kill, such as with judicial punishments. And I think that's a really valid question. I think, you know, it gets a little bit complicated, but I think theologically we're fairly firm ground on that. Go on.
I have a different... What's your take on the opposite? So obviously now we're going in biotechnology where we can use xenohumanism, so we can grow human organs in pigs. Transhumanism, where we're using AI and actual technology to extend life.
Yep.
So in terms of that, how does that argument... Then obviously we're still taking the choice from God away as to when we're supposed to be dying. So my question to you is, at what point do we, you know, with transhumanism, you can now replace hearts, this, that, and the other, and actually many people could probably live to 400-500 years, you know, if you constantly replace the stem cells and everything else in terms of the technology.
Well, theoretically, we're not there yet.
Yeah, we're not there
because
yet.
If we were, people would be doing that.
For me, it's the fact that we're growing. So one of the things for me, like in liver transplants, fundamentally a lot of liver transplants is because it's either non-fatty alcoholic liver disease or alcoholic liver disease. We're now growing livers in pigs, basically genetically modifying pigs for people who basically... Isn't that against God as well?
I think there's a difference. So I'm not going into the medical ethics of every single situation you just described.
Yeah.
Some of them would have all sorts of medical ethics. I'd go red flag.
Yeah.
But is it against, is that against God or fighting against God to seek to use medicine to prolong life? Is basically what your question boils down to? Or is
it's seek to use
really advanced and futuristic medicine to prolong life?
What I'm saying is now one of the things that they're trying to do is to put, because they believe consciousness is a program.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that they are working towards immortality, uploading consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, the whole
and I don't think that will work. But
yeah.
I think the desire to live forever in a way that is not through Christ is a new Babel. You know that,
and so
yes, that is turning away from God and seeking to make a name for ourselves, make our own names great, and live forever. And that won't work. And I think that is an act of rebellion against God. The desire, I would put that in a different category from the desire to cure diseases, even self-inflicted diseases, through new livers or whatever else, which I think is a desire to help people live the life that they're currently in to the full. And I think there's two distinct things going on there.
I think the problem for me is...
Last one and then we'll get to the question.
Yeah, no, actually, to be honest, I could discuss this all day. But I was just saying a lot of people don't live their fulfillment.
No.
Do you know what I mean? And this is where I think we've got to really bring back the magic of what life is.
100%.
Because a lot of the times you ain't extending a life in which they're going to be spending the next 6 months watching TV anyway.
Yeah.
Using a horrendous experimental drugs that's basically killed God knows how many animals. Right?
Yeah, and sometimes, medical interventions are great in the way they extend life. Sometimes actually you've got to say, look, why are we always trying to extend life?
Yeah.
I think that's often when that initial question, why has support for assisted suicide risen in recent years? Often people ask, one of the responses I get when I ask a group that is because we're artificially prolonging life so long when actually sometimes we need to allow people to die sooner.
Can you explain, Pete, why you think the legislation is likely to be passed?
Yeah, very, very simply, I think why do I think legislation is likely to be passed? I think our sense is that the House of Lords is probably slightly more pro-assisted suicide than the House of Commons.
Right.
It's not 100% sure. In the debate that was a couple of weeks ago, you could count the number of speeches in favour and the number of speeches against, and there were way more speeches against assisted suicide. But the fact is that you have about 300 or so peers who are actively engaging in this debate, and 600 or so peers who are going to vote. And from what we can gather, we think that there are more pro-assisted suicide votes in the Lords.
But we should still write.
Oh yeah, still right, because God can do all things. It's important to be a witness, even if we lose terribly. And we might not lose terribly, and it might be close. It's one of these things. The Lords hasn't voted on this, because you know, it's the Commons who've had the votes on it every few years, not the Lords. So let's wait and see. Yeah.
You can guess the answer, but I shouldn't guess the answer. You just articulate briefly what the mechanics are of the funding for palliative care in countries that have taken this approach. Reducing? I can guess the answer, but it'd be useful to, you know, what's the...
So why in the countries that have legalised assisted suicide euthanasia, why has palliative care dropped? Is that your question?
Yeah.
I think that's a hard question to give a single answer to, but I think most of these countries... budgets are tight.
So it's a costed option.
Yeah, budgets are tight. And as more people are choosing assisted suicide, it just means providing good palliative care becomes less important in the mind of the budget setters.
Mm.
I think there's other parts of it. I mean, palliative care, I think, is a fundamentally Christian approach of how can we love the weakest and most vulnerable, and the reality is that the places that have legalized assisted suicide and euthanasia are some of the most de-Christianizing places, and so, you know, is it cause, is it effect, we don't know, but it has dropped everywhere.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions? Yeah.
How does the role of the bishops in the House of Lords play into the debate?
So they'll get their vote. What's that?
Most of them aren't my shoes.
Yeah, so I mean, they've got their role, they've got their place, they'll make some speeches, they'll vote. I think on the whole we expect most of them to hopefully vote with us, although you know the Anglican bishops in the House of Lords are a mixed bag. So but on the whole it's probably better for us that they're there than not. And we work with some of them, and others have got less time for us. Should we have one more question, and then you can chat to me afterwards if you've got any more.
I just wanted to make one more statement.
Oh, sorry, just next to you, there's a question from someone who hasn't spoken as much.
you were talking there about the church, what can the church do. But have you got some examples of what good looks like in your mind for the church that we can take away and think about?
Yeah, in short, no concrete examples from other places, because I think often the church has dropped the ball on this. As I was chatting to this Canadian chap last week, he was saying he was trying to get churches mobilised on this a decade ago, and 10 years after it's passed, they're just starting to think maybe we should do something about it. So many churches have not been asking those questions, which is why there aren't any great models that I'm aware of. But when it comes to what we should be doing, I think the one thing we need to focus on is what was raised in some of those answers you gave earlier, which is how can we fight against the loneliness epidemic? I think two things, fight against the loneliness epidemic and teach well so that the church does not compromise. And as we do that, some churches, just as with abortion, some churches say, well, we're going to do something different. We're going to run a club for new mothers, and we're going to give support to those who don't have the baby buggies or the clothes or whatever. And they create entire ministries around that. And I wonder if there will be some scope for churches to create ministries in this area. Maybe, you know, a new care home where we say, we're going to run this, and who knows? I think we're going to have to... I think what my role is to invite people to think about it. I'm not brilliant at coming up with all the ideas, but I know that in the church there are those people. So I see my role here in 2025 as sowing those seeds so the entrepreneurs in the church can go, here's what we can do. Yeah.
I'll just say thank you for coming.
Oh, it's been a joy. I love... Yeah, I've loved talking to you. I've enjoyed your questions. I'm not rushing off. So if you have more questions, just come and chat to me afterwards. Please help yourself to resources. And can I say as well, I mentioned sign-ups at the beginning. And like I say, that's a really big way you can support our work and help us gain influence in Parliament. But to put it really bluntly, there's also a bit of a competition in the office at the moment as to who can get the most people to sign up. And can I tell you what joy it would bring me to walk into my office the day after tomorrow with a big pile of completed forms. So please do consider signing up. You can fill in the form, use the QR code, or follow us on social media. That's also wonderful. But thank you for coming. Thank you for your attention. It's been a blessing for me as well.
Thank you, Peter. I think we are appreciating it. Thank you.